Well, brother, last time that I had a chance to speak with you, we asked the question, what in the world is going on? More importantly, we asked, what is going to go on? What does the future hold? What is going to be happening off into the future? We discussed the fact that approximately two-thirds of the Bible might be considered prophecy. And of that two-thirds of the Bible, as much as 90% of it deals with this group the Bible calls Israel. Therefore, one of the great keys to understanding what in the world is going to happen in the future is understanding whom the Bible is speaking about when it talks of Israel. You may know the answer to that question. Who is Israel? But could you take someone through the Bible to help them understand if they have no background in this topic at all? That's been our goal as we began this series. So if you were not able to be here, or just because it's been 2 weeks by way of review, last time, what did we cover? We asked the question, who was Israel? And we showed from the book of Genesis that Israel actually was a man, the man Jacob, the third of the patriarchs, as we call them. We have Abraham, then we have Isaac, and then we have his son Jacob. Jacob wrestled with God. We talked about how Jacob's name meant a supplanter, one who'd pull the rug out from under your feet, or pull your feet out from under you if you had the chance. His name was changed after wrestling with God. We talked about that wrestling match and what it must have been like. But we know that at that point, his name was changed by God to Israel. We talked about how most likely the best probably translation of the name Israel, the meaning, is overcomer with God. So Jacob went from being a supplanter, a one who'd pull the rug out from under you, to being an overcomer, overcame much of that nature with the help of God. So when the Bible talks about a single man, Israel, it's talking about the patriarch Jacob. And then we reviewed that Jacob had 12 sons plus a number of daughters. And those 12 sons, the Bible calls the children of Jacob, or the children of Israel. So when the Bible speaks literally of the children of Israel directly, it's talking about those 12 sons. And we talked about how those 12 sons married sometimes more than once and had children. And they had lots of children. And so those 12 sons of Jacob grew into tribes. So the 12 tribes of Israel were overseen, or had their own patriarch, we might say, one of the sons of Jacob. So all of that group, as they grow, are called the children of Israel, in the sense of being descendants from Israel or Jacob. So we have Jacob the man, Israel. We have the 12 sons of Israel. And then we have the tribes that grow from that. And as those tribes then come together as a group, they might be called the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel, that we know by the time they left Egypt after a couple hundred years of captivity, had grown to be 2 to 3 million people. So the children of Israel is a reference to all of those who descended, came from Jacob or Israel. Now, we also mentioned that prophetically, Genesis very clearly shows us that the name Israel would be carried prophetically much more specifically by two groups. We talked about how Joseph brought his two sons, Ephraim the younger, Manasseh the older, brought them to Jacob for a blessing. And Jacob brought the boys forward, and he crossed his hands and put his right hand on the younger Ephraim, his other hand on Manasseh the older, which was backwards, at least it was thought to be backwards, and he blessed them. And something significant he said, let my name be named upon them. And not just, oh, carry my name, like we would say to our grandchildren, you know, make the family name good. We've got a family identity. Hold it up. Make us proud. Hold up the family name the way you should. No, he said, let my name be named upon them as Reuben and Simeon, his first two-born. So he was actually taking Reuben and Simeon and setting them aside and putting Ephraim and Manasseh in their seats. So now Ephraim was like his firstborn, and Manasseh was like his secondborn. They, the sons of Joseph, would now carry the name Israel prophetically off into the future. And we'll show how that develops over the course of time. So when we read about Israel, we have to determine from the context what is being discussed. Is it the man? Is it the 12 sons? Is it the tribes that descend from them? Is it the nation that comes from them? Or is it more specifically the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Jacob? And we described as well how, even though Levi is dispersed and doesn't really have a tribal identity in the same way, that the two sons of Joseph take that place. Ephraim drops out. Joseph becomes Ephraim and Manasseh. So we still have 12 tribes. We talked about how then the nation of Israel becomes the kingdom of Israel. They ask if they could please have, maybe they didn't say please, they wanted a king to rule over them so that they could be like the other nations. Samuel's upset. He says, that's a bad idea. They say, we want it anyway. God says, Samuel, give them their king. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me from being king over them. So now we have the kingdom of Israel. And that kingdom is ruled by a single king. The united monarchy. We have Saul, and then we have David, and then we have Solomon, the kingdom of Israel, all 12 tribes being ruled over by one king. And then remember, Solomon sinned in such a degree that God was going to take the kingdom away. So you remember the story. Israel splits into two parts, two houses. Remember, Jeroboam is leaving the city. The prophet Ahijah pulls him aside, takes his brand new cloak, and rips it into 12 pieces. Now, it's significant again. I'll remind us that it's significant that it's torn into 12 pieces. Because when we think of Israel, sometimes we think of this lost 10 tribes as being one group that goes all over the place. It just never happened. There were 12 pieces. He said, take 10 of those, they'll be Israel. And 2 will be left for Judah, for the house of David. 10 and 2. So splits into 2 parts. The northern kingdom would be called the kingdom of Israel, or the house of Israel. And the southern, composed of Judah and Benjamin, would be the house, or the kingdom of Judah. And so one of the important things we described is that most Israelites are not Jews. The tribe of Judah and Benjamin and the Levites that were with them came to be called Judah or Jews, Yehuda, as we talked about last time in the Hebrew. And the Israelites are a completely different group of people. They're all sons of Jacob, but only a small group become referred to as Jews. And that's an important distinction to know. From this time forward, Israel will refer to the northern 10 tribes. Judah would refer to the southern 2 tribes. Now, does that mean Judah will never be called children of Israel? Well, no, they still are children of Israel. They're still descended from Jacob. So we'll see a few occasions where Judah is actually called the children of Israel. Sometimes they're asked, men of Israel. Well, they're still Israelites, but they're not all Israel. And we'll see how that develops from here. So let's continue on. That was a brief thumbnail sketch of what we took 1 hour and 10 minutes to cover before. And you're probably saying, why couldn't we have covered it in that summary form last time? But that's just the way it is. Let's continue on with our points from here. First thing is this. Both houses sin. We have the house of Israel in the north. Who did we say would lead the house of Israel? Who was placed in Reuben's spot to lead Israel? It was Ephraim. Where does the first king of Israel come from? We'll see that as we go along. It comes from Ephraim. 1 Kings chapter 12 in verse 20. Up to 1 Kings 12, we have the United Monarchy. We have the end of Solomon's life, the third king in the United Monarchy, the Kingdom of Israel. Now we see this split taking place. And Jeroboam, the new king of Israel, starts to lead the northern 10 tribes. Sadly, he led them directly into sin. 1 Kings 12, notice in verse 20. Now it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had come back, they sent for him, called him to the congregation, and made him king over all Israel. Now pause for a second. You have the phrase, all Israel. Does that mean all 12 tribes? Notice the rest of the verse. There was none who followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. And we mentioned Benjamin was so small, it was considered really a part of the tribe of Judah. So what we have is now we have the northern tribes referring to themselves as all Israel. Oh, you got the Jews down there, the Judahites, but we're Israel. So the name Israel clearly has made a transfer away from the Jews and to these northern 10 tribes led by Ephraim. In verse 21, when Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah, as opposed to the what? House of Israel. With the tribe of Benjamin, oh, there we go, house of Judah is with Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors to fight against the house of Israel. Have house of Judah, house of Israel. Could anything be clearer than these are two separate groups of people? And would remain so from that time forward. To fight against the house of Israel, that he might restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. They wanted to continue the united monarchy. It wasn't going to happen. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, verse 23, speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, who is the kingdom. Kingdom is who? Judah, Benjamin. How many times will God say it? Over and over and over again. The Jews are Judah, Benjamin, and many of the Levites that stayed with the temple service. Who is Israel? The other 10 tribes. Say to the king, or to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Eternal, you shall not go up nor fight against your brothers, the children of Israel. Now they're called the children. Here's God speaking through the prophet saying, you Jews, don't go fight against Israel. Could anything be clearer than that these are two separate groups of people? Why do we keep emphasizing that? Because virtually all of modern Christianity says that the Jews are all of Israel. They all somehow got back together. Didn't happen. We'll see that time and time again. They're absolutely wrong when it comes to that concept. Verse 24, thus says the Eternal, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Let every man return to his house. Go home, for this thing is from me. God deliberately separates Israel from Judah. He deliberately does it. It's his doing. Now, Rehoboam played his part by being a stubborn fool. That's true. But it was God's intent. He had different destinies involved prophetically for these two groups of people. Therefore, they obeyed the word of the Lord and turned back according to the word of the Lord. Two separate groups. But what happens in Israel? Verse 25. Then Jeroboam, now what sometimes can be confusing is the southern king over Judah was called Rehoboam. The northern king is Jeroboam. They sound an awful lot alike, and it's easy to get them confused. But Jeroboam is to the north. Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim. Ephraim. Where did we say the northern kingdom would be centered? In Ephraim. Why? What did Jacob do with his right hand? Gave the blessing to Ephraim. Ephraim becomes the lead tribe of Israel, the leading tribe. So this altar is built in the hills of Ephraim. And he dwelt there. Also, he went out from there and built Penuel. So in this case, you have, okay, some protected areas. Verse 26, though. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. Pause there for a second. The kingdom of Judah, the house of Judah, is also known as what? The house of David. The house of David. So those terms are interchangeable. Verse 27. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. What did Jeroboam lack? Faith. Who told Rehoboam, I have made you king over Israel? God did. Now, Rehoboam would probably have taken everybody back. He wanted them back. But Jeroboam was afraid. So he set up idol worship. Verse 28, therefore the king asked advice. Be careful of whom you ask advice. He either asked advice and got horrible advice and followed it. What's the number one mistake people make in asking advice? They ask people who are just like them. I get on Facebook and I ask advice from all my pals. Don't let me get on Facebook again. What's the value in that? What's the value in that? Very little value. To get truly good advice, you must ask people who are not your pals. People who have literal expertise, possibly, who have experience in areas that you do not. Jeroboam made a serious mistake. He asked advice, either he asked his buds or he got good advice and just ignored it. But it sounds like the advice he got was this. He made two calves of gold and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Is that logical? Absolutely. Very logical. It's a long trip to Jerusalem. Stay close to home. I'm just trying to make it easy for you. Subtle, partly true. It's an awful hard to go up to Jerusalem, but it's what God asks. So he says, here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan, the north and the south. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before one as far as Dan. So he's got these two golden calves. Jeroboam's middle name was apparently Aaron. You know, he threw this stuff, and out comes these golden calves out of the fire. How'd that happen? Brethren, this sin was idolatry. Absolute walking away from the first and the second and the third commandment. Absolute walking away from it. So, he caused Israel to sin. It says, verse 31, he made shrines on the high places, made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. What did God said? The Levites, they will be the priests. So Jeroboam led Israel into sin. The very first king of Israel carries this people into idolatry, and this would be a sin from which they would never recover. Every single king of Israel would follow the sin of Jeroboam. Every single one. Not one righteous king in Israel. Not one. Now, some of the kings of Israel wouldn't be quite as bad as other kings. And we'll see that as we go along. But none of them ever got past the sin of Jeroboam. Verse 32. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month. Have you ever heard of people deciding when they should have their own feast? Days. Ho, ho, ho. I mean, it's unheard of, isn't it? Of course not. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. What's that? Well, you just back the Feast of Tabernacles off a month. May as well do it the eighth month. You know, there's more chance that you'll have everything better harvested by the eighth month. There's really a lot of sense in this eighth month feast. I mean, there was some logic to it. But as we've often said, logic does not mean something is logical. Doesn't mean it's right. They offered sacrifices on the altar. He did so at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel, he installed priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar, which he made at Bethel on the 15th day of the eighth month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. Jeroboam starts Israel out in sin. It is at that point that God began the countdown. There is a New Testament scripture that says, God is not mocked. What's the rest of that? As a man sows, so shall he reap. When I was a little boy, my mother had a kitchen timer. It was this clonky metal thing with a big white dial and lines on it, and there was 5, and then 10, 15, and 20. I don't know how high it went. But when she would put something into the oven, she'd turn that dial to whatever time this particular thing ought to be cooking, and it would start ticking. And when it finally hit the zero, it would make this awful ringing. There was some kind of bell mechanism there. It would whack against the outside of this metal container, and it would make you aware that, okay, the time is up. When Jeroboam led the people into sin, God set the timer. Now, nobody knew how long the timer was set for. But let's look at chapter 14. In verse 14, God made two predictions at that time. One is that Jeroboam and all his family would have to be executed for their sin, for doing something so ungodly as to leading millions of people into sin. He was going to have to die, and not just him, but all of his family. And the second prediction is here in verse 14. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam. I'm sorry, that's the first thing. This is the day. What? Even now. So we might say that there were two timers. One for Jeroboam personally and one for the nation. Because even though Jeroboam led people to idolatry, did they have to follow? No, but they did. So the entire nation is on a timer as well. Verse 15, for the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. And this is an extremely important prophecy right here. He will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers and will scatter them beyond the river. Two prophecies. One's Jeroboam's dying. Second, a critical prophecy. God is going to uproot. Many of us have gardens. What happens when you uproot a plant? You pull it completely out of the ground. It's not going to grow back, is it? Because you've uprooted it. But it doesn't just say uproot. You don't see Israel continuing on as a 10-tribe group for the rest of history. It says, I'm going to uproot them and scatter them. Remember how many pieces Jeroboam was given? 10. So when he says, I'm going to scatter them, each of those pieces would stick together, but be scattered all over the place. Scattered. So the kitchen timer is going off. God says it's going to happen. Jeroboam's going to die, number one. And number two, Israel is going to be uprooted and scattered. Just torn out and thrown out. Verse 5. Let's drop down to chapter 15. Chapter 15. As we mentioned, as that kitchen timer is ticking away, no one has any idea how much time is on the timer. Would it be a year? Would it be 10 years? Would it be 15 or 20 or half a decade or half a century? Would it be 100 years? It is interesting. The timer took almost 200 years to go off. And yet it just kept ticking away. 1 Kings 15, in verse 33. 1 Kings 15 and verse 33. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, became king over Israel in Tirzah and reigned 24 years. So we have two separate kingdoms. Very clearly, as the decades roll on, two separate kingdoms, two different kings. Verse 34. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, just like every other Israelite king. And it says, did what? Walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had made Israel sin. You'll see this phrase, the sin of Jeroboam, over and over and over again. You'll see this, the phrase, the way of Jeroboam, over and over and over again. And even though some of the kings of Israel wouldn't be as bad, none of them ever got away from the sin of Jeroboam. And what two things? What two things primarily composed the way or the sin of Jeroboam? Idolatry and false feast keeping. Ring a bell to today's America? Idolatry, false feast keeping. Any different today? Interesting to think. Where has Israel gone? We could talk more about that, but this sin of Jeroboam over and over again. Now, some of the kings of Israel didn't just have this false worship of Yahweh, because indications are they called their cows, their golden calves, they called them Yahweh. They called them by God's name. Wouldn't surprise me for a second that they called that feast in the eighth month the Feast of Tabernacles. Wouldn't surprise me a bit. And yet, others added even more to that. Have others adding to Jeroboam's sin and starting to worship Baal and Marduk, some of the other gods. Some are building temples in high places to these other pagan gods as well. So then you have some kings of Israel who actually are reformers. And they come on the scene and they throw Baal out. But they never get rid of the sin of Jeroboam. And hopefully you can see modern day parallels. You got people out there who are trying to reform Christianity. Let's get Christ back in. Wait a second. Get Christ back in Christmas? He was never there to begin with. He doesn't belong there. That's one of the false feasts. It's one of the sins of Jeroboam. How can you put Christ back into the sins of Jeroboam? It's like saying, get rid of Baal and let's go sacrifice to that golden calf. It's just as foolish and just as sinful. And people say, well, it's such a holy time of year. It's malarkey. It's just not true. It's the sin of Jeroboam all over again. It's idolatry and it is false holy day worship. It's just wrong. Now again, can some reform and be a little bit better than that? Well, sure. But they don't get rid of the sin of Jeroboam, do they? Same thing we see today. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 3. We have kings of Israel cycling through the office, and yet none getting rid of the sin of Jeroboam. 2 Kings chapter 3, in verse 1. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. He reigned 12 years. Now, Ahab was one of the more evil kings of Israel. And yet, toward the end of his life, he tried to turn things around a little bit. And he did throw out Baal worship and some of those things, but never overcame the sins of Jeroboam. His son, Jehoram, was not as good. Verse 2, he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, but not like his father and mother, for he put away the sacred pillar of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he persisted in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. He did not depart from them. Every king of Israel wrapped up in idolatry and false holy day keeping, wrong holy day keeping, every single one. So the kitchen timer is ticking away. It's getting closer and closer to zero. Now, what about Judah? What about the southern kingdom? How different were they? Well, what is interesting about the southern kingdom is they have a mixed bag. We said every king of Israel was evil. Every single one of them followed the sins of Jeroboam. The interesting thing in the southern kingdom of Judah is you got a couple good ones and a couple evil ones. And you might have a great king that's following God to the best of his ability, and the very next one is an idol worshiper, turns things completely around. And then somebody comes along and he completely turns things back to God. And then the next one turns away. So you have great kings like Hezekiah who turn everyone to God, who strive with all their heart to follow the truth in every way. And then you have his son, Manasseh, being one of the most evil kings Judah would ever see. So in the southern kingdom, you have this on-again, off-again routine of a righteous king and an unrighteous king, or two or three unrighteous kings. And then maybe a righteous or one or two kings in a row who truly follow the way of God, who don't participate in the sin of Jeroboam at all. It's on and off again. Of the 20 kings of Judah that are listed in the scripture, how many do you think were righteous before God? That it said they did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Any idea? I wouldn't have known unless I looked it up. Eight. Eight actually said they did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Now, some better than others. Eight, we might say, were righteous. A few others were evil but repented toward the end of their lives. So you might even increase that number just a little bit. But the rest simply were idolatrous as well. But due to those righteous kings, God was merciful to the nation. Due to the promises God made to David, he was merciful to the southern kingdom of Judah. And he allowed their timer to be set for a much longer period of time. Now, because most of the people were going after idols, the kitchen timer was running in Judah as well. There would be a time when the timer goes off, punishment is inevitable. Be sure our sins, as Moses wrote, be sure your sins will find you out. God will not be mocked. We will reap what we sow. Let's turn to 2 Kings 3 here and look again in verse 1. The reason I want to reread verse 1 here is because kings are now being chronicled by the timetable in the other nation. Jeroboam, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria, or Jehoram, I should say. The son of Ahab became king over Israel at Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. So they're chronicled by one another's reigns. Two very separate kingdoms. Let's turn to chapter 16 now. Skip ahead to 2 Kings 16 in verse 6. There's much more we could say about the nation of Judah, the kingdom of Judah, the house of Judah, the house of David, and how their kitchen timer is ticking away. A little bit longer time span that they'll have before that timer will go off. But what's important here is to again reemphasize that we very clearly have two distinct nations who will never again be reunited until, a point for later on, until Christ's return. 2 Kings chapter 6, in verse 6. The context here is we marched on several decades since we were just reading in chapter 3. 2 Kings chapter 16 in verse 6. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, Rezin, you might remember, was quite a sticky character as king of Syria. When he got together with an accelerant, he got quite hardened. His heart was hardened before God, no doubt. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath. The men of Judah. That's the way it's reading here in the New King James. It's the Hebrew word Yehudi. Everywhere else, except for one other place, about 70 other places, this term is translated Jews. And that's what the word means. Now, why the New King James translators decided here that they would put men of Judah instead of the Jews is a mystery to every translator that I've looked up to try to sort. Why did they choose that here and not anywhere else? The same word, same context, same kind of scripture, but it's always Jews. So if we read it that way, it is interesting to note, at that time, Rezin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah, or the Jews, from Elath. Then the Edomites went to Elath and dwelt there to this day. Now, isn't it interesting that here the Jews are driven from a city? Who were the Jews at war with? Well, we read about Rezin, king of Syria, but let's go back to verse 1. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. He did not do that what was right in the sight of God, as David his father has done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. He sacrificed and burned incense in the high places on the hills under every green tree. Interesting, he's following the sins of Israel. Idolatry, in this case, very severe idolatry, sacrificing his own children. But who is allied with Rezin, king of Syria? It's the Israelites. Notice in verse 7. Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rides up against me. So our point is, the first time the word Jews is used in the Bible, the Jews are at war with Israel and with Syria. So those who claim that Jews refers to all of the Israelites, they somehow all got back together, simply don't understand what the scriptures say. They don't know. Either they're being willingly ignorant or they're just ignorant. And that's not meant as an insult. When you're ignorant, you don't know. You just don't know. So here, the first time the word Jews appears in the Hebrew, they are at war with Israel. At war. The New King James translates this, as I said, 70 other times as Jews. Only two places, men of Judah. So we understand that both houses, the house of Israel and the house of Judah, fall into idolatry and they fall into false feast keeping. Sad but true. Both have the kitchen timer ticking away. Because of righteous kings in Judah, they have a little bit more time on their timer than Israel does. So what is our next point? Our second point for today, at least, is that the northern 10 tribes disappear. The northern 10 tribes disappear. So we might say Israel disappears. Here in 2 Kings, the next chapter, chapter 17, we see the kitchen timer going off. What did God say when he set the timer? What would he do? Two things he said he would do to Israel. One, of course, was kill Jeroboam because of his sin, leading all Israel. But that's not the important. There were two other things. I will uproot and I will scatter. Israel disappears. It is uprooted and scattered. Let's look at that. 2 Kings 17 and verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, that's in the area of Ephraim. And he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. How so? Well, that means he threw out Baal, but kept the sins of Jeroboam. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal. How did the Assyrians typically conquer a people? They'd come and smash a few of their cities on the border areas. And then they'd threaten them, if you don't pay us and become servants to us, we'll continue this process. Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt. So was not a very good king, actually. They called him So-So most of the time. Okay, I just made that up too. He sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. So what did Hoshea do? He took the tribute money that should have gone to Assyria and sent it to Egypt to say, please help us out. Please help defend us against Assyria. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Stage two. Assyrians came down, grabbed the leadership, imprisoned them, took over leadership of the area, put in people that they thought would help, that they would follow them and do as they told or were told. In verse 5, now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, took Samaria. 9th year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, took Samaria. What happened? The kitchen timer went off. And it was time for the uprooting and the scattering. In the 9th year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, took Samaria, placed them in Hala by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. Basically directly north from where they were. City of the Medes were up near the Black Sea. So we understand that Israel was carried away. Does that sound like to you they joined back together with the Jews? Joined the kingdom of Judah? Not at all. They were carried away. Taken away. Notice verse 7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Eternal their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt. For under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, they had feared other gods and walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel, and the kings of Israel, which they had made. That's why they were in captivity now. That's why they were carried away. That's why they were uprooted and scattered. So if you'd like a ballpark figure, it's about 720 B.C. About 720 B.C. You might say 718 if you like more specifics, 21 to 17. Now, 721 to 718 was that period of time of the three-year invasion, apparently, of Samaria. But about 720 is a good ballpark figure. Notice in 2 Kings chapter 18 now, next chapter, beginning in verse 9. Assyria was the power to be feared. They crushed Israel and carried away the Israelites. How was Judah going to escape this same power? 2 Kings 18 in verse 9. Now it came to pass in the 4th year of King Hezekiah, which was the 7th year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, that's in what, the 9th year we just read, the end of 3 years they took it. In the 6th year of Hezekiah, that is the 9th year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. The nation's capital was crushed. The king of Assyria, verse 11, carried Israel away captive to Assyria, put them in Hala by the river Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. Why would the Assyrians do that? It's a brilliant move, really. You see, if you leave people in their land, they know the land like no place else. They know it like the back of their hand. They know all the places to cut off, to ambush, to do all these things. So the Assyrians literally would rip people out of their land, put them in somebody else's land, take people from that land, put them there. So the Israelites actually took Babylonians and put them in Samaria. They became the Samaritans of history, of the New Testament history. So you have these Assyrians taken away. You have Babylonians put in their spot. Did Israel ever come back? There was no place to come back to. Other people were living there. They never came back to this area, ever. Never came back. Verse 12. Because they did not obey the voice of their God, but transgressed his covenant and all that Moses, the servant of the Eternal, had commanded. And they would neither hear nor do them. There is no return of Israel ever mentioned. For 200 years, they had been a separate kingdom from the Jews, from Judah. Why on earth would they come back and join together with Judah? Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. They never repented of the sins of Jeroboam. And frankly, they haven't to this day, to be honest. That's another sermon. They'd been a separate nation for 200 years, then taken into captivity, and they would never blend back together with the Jews. Let's review as to why any of this is important. Why are we taking such extensive time to show the history of Israel as one man, 12 sons, entire tribes, then nation, then kingdom, then split kingdom, now divided kingdom, one disappearing into history? These 10 tribes become what has often been referred to as the lost tribes of Israel, the lost 10 tribes, because now they just disappear. We know where they went to start. That's what the Bible records. We know where they went. If we can find out where the river Gozan is, if we can find out what the cities of the Medes were, where Halath is and Habor, then we know where they are, where they were. We know where they started out. But God said he would scatter them, not just uproot them, but scatter them. They would continue to scatter from here. Why is all this important? Again, since 90% of prophecy deals with Israel. If we're going to have any understanding of prophecy, we must know who Israel is. And what have we established to this point? Israel is not the Jews. So when we read prophecies of Israel, we are not reading about Jews. What is the number one mistake most of Christianity makes with regard to prophecy? The number one mistake is that anything that refers to Israel has to be talking about the Jews today. And that's simply error. It's wrong. Not the case at all. When prophecies talk about Israel, it is not talking about Jews. So, that's what we've established at this point. Now, we do have four other points that we'd like to cover today, but we don't have time. So what we'll do, since I've already been talking nearly an hour, we'll go ahead and call it quits for today and pick up keys to understanding prophecy and the modern identity of Israel next time.